Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now, the editor of The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Radio Hour here on WNYC, David Remnick. Hi, David. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Good. Did I read last month that The New Yorker just became the first magazine ever to win a Pulitzer Prize for journalism?
I'm delighted to report that you're right. That what happened was the Pulitzers were opened up to magazines just last year. And a woman named Jennifer Gonerman, who's a great New York City reporter, was a finalist. So that was more than encouraging and terrific. And then this year, I learned from sources close to the Pulitzers, that's the way it works, they kind of leak it a little bit, that two New Yorker writers, Catherine Schultz, who's a critic and a feature writer, and Emily Nussbaum, who writes television criticism for us, were going to win Pulitzers. And Bill Finnegan, who's a longtime writer at The New Yorker and who wrote a memoir called Barbarian Days about his peregrinations all around the world for his entire life as a surfer, was going to win the Pulitzer for not general nonfiction. So there it was, three New Yorker writers in 1 year, and I had the great privilege. It was the most fun I've ever done. You know, when you're wearing your pants anyway. Calling these writers and saying, you know, tomorrow you're going to get a call and you're going to win the Pulitzer Prize. And when I called Emily, she didn't know which David was calling her. That took a little while to clear up. And then she called me every name in the book because she thought I was, let's just say, not telling the truth. Somehow. It was really fun.
It was April Fool's Day when you called Emily Nussbaum.
Like that. Yeah.
Can you coo about Emily for a minute? Emily Nussbaum, who is so great writing about television, and the committee cited her for writing about TV with shrewdness and affection. And I thought, that's amazing. Those are two attributes you don't hear together very often, shrewdness and affection. They don't even go together. Do you think it gets something about Emily's writing?
Well, I think Emily Nussbaum is influential and important to this television renaissance that we're having, in the same way that Pauline Kael was in the 70s when movies were, in a way, the hot pop cultural thing, you know, from Bonnie and Clyde on. And Emily watches everything she possibly can, and she's excited by an enormous amount of television. I mean, it's not a kind of critical stance in which she thinks everything kind of stinks and let's just find the most clever way to say how much it does stink, which is not an uncommon critical stance in any field. She has a real passion for this stuff, and she's lucky. She's lucky. She's a television critic in the midst of a renaissance brought on by the possibilities, well, first of all, of technology, first of cable television and now of Netflix. There's so much more interesting television now that's going on than certainly when I was growing up in a three-network world. And so she's overwhelmed with things to write about. You know, the old days of TV criticism at the New York Times, the only thing they'd ever praise, I mean, long ago, was, you know, very solemn stuff or British stuff on PBS, and everything else was considered to be low rent.
It is a good time. I always knew you were a great magazine editor, but I never knew until the New Yorker Radio Hour started this year how good an interviewer and conversationalist you are. You're really good on the radio, and I'm going to play just a one-minute clip from last week's episode with you interviewing Siddhartha Mukherjee about his new book, The Gene, and you were noticing that the human genome gets beyond science into realms like politics and the culture wars.
That even comes to the point of sexuality. The book discusses the hunt for the so-called gay gene. Mm-hmm. What's the latest thinking on that? Because I know that that's come up any number of times in the last 15, 20 years. And how did the publicity around that debate shape the course of gay rights in this country?
So one question that we keep coming back to over and over again in the book is that, you know, you might think naively that genetics is a scientific problem or a scientific question. The point here is that genetics is reorganizing in a radical way the way we think about race, the way we think about sexuality, identity, you know, transgenderism, all the stuff that is raging, the divisive debates that are raging in the political realm.
That are seemingly a cultural debate.
That are seemingly cultural debates, are political debates, are really debates about human beings and identity. And if they are debates about human beings and identity, then they have to be debates about genes. There's no, it's ipso facto, they're debates about genes.
Siddhartha Mukherjee, author of The Gene, on the New Yorker Radio Hour with host and New Yorker editor David Remnick. David is with us. That little sequence is like The New Yorker itself. You're making connections across disciplines from science to politics to American culture. And Mukherjee is a pretty inspiring thinker, isn't he?
He's amazing. I think you know more than anybody, because I've been listening to you for years with such pleasure, that when you've got somebody on the other side of the table that's in complete command and has a kind of fluency like Sid Mukherjee, you're in business. You're happy. You're lucky. And really just have to put him in the way of good luck, and which is to say questions that he can answer in full, and then occasionally put some pressure on those answers when you're either in a position of debating them or you're confused, or you don't understand, or you get the sense that maybe your audiences could use a little explanation. He's an astonishing science writer, and his first book was The Emperor of All Maladies, which was about cancer, which won the Pulitzer and much else, and now The Gene, which I think within a 2.5 seconds shot up to number 3 or something on Amazon. He's a remarkable person.
What's your interviewing and editing process at the Radio Hour? Like, this show is almost 100% live, right? So there's no editing process except furiously in my head while in the middle of conversations with people. The producer of Fresh Air has joked that they generally lop off the first six minutes of Terry's interviews so the first words in the final version that airs can be right to the heart of the matter. And that's a joke, but it gets at something real about editing live long-form interviews. Do you have a pattern yet?
The pattern is to put myself in much more capable hands. David Krasnow, who's a veteran from WNYC, we have a whole team here from WNYC, in the office. Our studio is one floor above where I'm sitting right now on the 38th floor of One World Trade Center. They know what they're doing. I'm a radio amateur, which you're too nice to say, but it's absolute truth. It's a very complicated skill that's honed over a period of time. And I have no idea how they put up with me. In other words, an interview that may air for about somewhere between 15 and 20 minutes, I may spend 45 minutes at least in the studio talking with that person. So, first of all, I get very interested in what they're saying. Second of all, I'm insecure that I've given them enough to work with. That's a problem as an editor of a written piece, which is what I do during 95% of my time, because if somebody gives you, for a piece that's meant to be about 5,000 words, 20,000 words, you're in trouble because you're not quite sure where the structure is to be found for the 5,000-word piece. It's a problem. So for the moment, I'm probably going way, way too long than David Krasnow and his team would prefer, but I hope to – look, it took Terry Gross quite a while to get to the point where she's the, you know, like you, the, you know, the equivalent of LeBron James or Steph Curry when in the interviewing game.
Yeah, but for me, I have to try to jump live past those first 6 minutes of warm-up, which often would be an opportunity to establish a nice human connection because they'd usually be boring radio and dive right in the middle of things, yet still make it sound like, hello, here we both are together. How do you do? I was reading your own articles from the last year or so before coming on today, and I noticed and my guest is David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, a really interesting profile you did of Secretary of State Kerry back in December. And you reminded us that after he was the Democratic nominee for president back in 2004, he refused to challenge the results, even though he had a suspicion that in certain very close states, like Ohio, where the Electoral College was really won that year, and just barely, that proxies for Bush had rigged many voting machines. Really, Kerry believed that there were rigged voting machines?
He did, And the evidence of this is I was at dinner. The longest interview I had with him was at dinner at his house with his wife and a couple of aides. The aides said nothing, and they were kind of off to the side. And as we ate, I did my business. I asked the questions. And his wife, who's been, you remember, was a very vivid presence on the campaign trail.
Teresa Hines Carey.
Yes, and coming from and really the wealth in that marriage. She's the widow of the Carey fortune, of the Hines fortune. And they have, you know, these magnificent houses all over the place. And we're sitting in the Georgetown mansion having dinner. And I, a little gingerly, brought up the 2004 campaign. I think nobody can quite understand what it is to both run for president and then lose, and then lose very, very narrowly, and lose to George W. Bush. And it was very clear from his kind of elliptical comments, but then a kind of rush of talk from her, it's very clear that within that marriage, there was a great sense of injury, suspicion, a sense that they had been cheated at some level. But Kerry decided that after the 2000 trauma, and with scant evidence of what was going on in Ohio, not sufficient evidence, that they wouldn't pursue it. But that doesn't mean they ever forgot it.
And so what was remarkable to me after that, even realizing, because I didn't realize it before, that Kerry thinks that election might have been stolen from him, is that you then go on to tell a story of Kerry using that defeat in Ohio and his suspicions about it as leverage to try to avoid a political breakdown in Afghanistan. Can you tell that story just a little bit?
Sure. So what was happening in Afghanistan while he was not even Secretary of State yet, he was basically an envoy for President Obama, that there were heavily, heavily contested elections in Afghanistan, more than once. And Obama sent Kerry to Afghanistan to try to get the person who came in second to step aside, essentially, and to find a compromise, because otherwise there was a potential civil war brewing in Afghanistan, as if Afghanistan didn't have enough problems already. And Kerry, as a means of kind of personalizing the situation and personalizing his own diplomacy there, appealed to both sides, saying, look at what happened to me. Look at what happened in 2000 in the United States. We had to find a resolution, however outrageous you or I might think it was in the Supreme Court. There was a legal resolution to it. And in 2004, I felt, and he led on, basically, I felt that I'd been jobbed. I'd been cheated. But I had to step aside for the good of civil peace in the Republic.
And it worked.
And for civil peace. But
well, they don't have civil peace.
Yeah,
I mean,
Afghanistan.
Yes, he got Abdullah to withdraw the challenge that he was making to the legitimacy of the government.
Correct. And that was a kind of diplomatic triumph.
That's a great story, and I guess comes from you having traveled around the world with him for that 25-page. You know, I printed that article out so I could mark it up for this interview. It's 25 pages.
Well, you must have used big print.
Not really, but that's one of the great ongoing things about The New Yorker. You still do long, long form once in a while. And in our last minute, David, I saw that your most recent profile was of Aretha Franklin. Such a wide range from John Kerry to Aretha Franklin. Why did you decide to write about her at this point in her life?
You know, I saw that video of her singing at the Kennedy Center, singing the Carol song, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, and it brought not only me to tears, but everybody. And so I decided to go back and re-examine that career, go visit her, and it really was something, it was pure indulgence on my part, and I really enjoyed doing it. I love her.
Indulgence on our part, spending some time with New Yorker editor and New Yorker Radio Hour host David Remnick. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure always, Brian.